This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you hear the word improv, you probably think comedy, right? Night at the Improv or Saturday Night Live. But what about using the fundamentals of improv to talk about science, to talk about stuff that's not guaranteed to make the audience go wild? You know, crowd pleasers like thermodynamics and particle physics and gene mutation rates. Well, this idea of mixing improv and science was the brainchild of one of my next guests, a science-obsessed kid who ended up going into Hollywood instead. You know him as Alan Alda, actor and writer and board member of the World Science Festival. He's also co-founder and visiting professor at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University in New York. Welcome back, Alan. Always
thank
good to see
you, Ira.
Also joining us today is Valerie Lance Geffrow. She's the Improvisation Program Director at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
We're not going to be taking your calls today, but you can comment on Twitter at SciFry or at ScienceFriday.com. Alan, I want to start by asking you about your experience with improv, because you worked with Viola Spolin, the great improv teacher who founded the Young Actors Company in Los Angeles, and her son, Paul Sills. What were her workshops like? What kind of stuff did you learn there?
Well, she has, must have been about 70 years ago that she first worked with children and wrote a book about it called Improvisation for the Theater. And I worked with mostly Paul Sills, her son. He's the guy who started Second City. Mm-hmm. But the workshops we did had nothing to do with comedy. They were really this basic form of improvising that Viola invented, which I found transformed me as an actor and as a person. And everybody I know who has done it had the same experience. You get opened up. You become available to the other people you're working with. You have to, because that's the nature of the exercises and mostly games that you play. And when I was doing Scientific American Frontiers, the program on PBS where I must have interviewed about, 700 scientists, I realized that we were actually doing little improvisational conversations. That's why they were so lively and interesting, because mm-hmm. they weren't standard questions and answers. So that conversational approach made me think, if there's nobody standing there next to the scientist drawing the science out of them in a more human way, what would help the scientist do that? And that, I felt, was learning improvisation. But this kind of, this basic kind of improv, not where you try to turn the scientist into a comedian or an actor or make him quick on his feet. It's the connection. It's the relating that comes out of the improv that's so valuable. Because then when you turn to an audience, you relate to them in that same personal way.
But is there any value in humor, though, for the scientists?
Oh, sure, sure.
They learn this.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's not a jokey kind of humor.
Right.
It's the pleasure of spontaneity. So mm-hmm. that if something occurs to you in that split second, it's free to come out. You trust it. You trust yourself. And the audience is delighted, I think, even more by the spontaneity than by the jokey element of that, mm-hmm. that would be coming out if it weren't as spontaneous.
Mm-hmm. Valerie, you direct the improv program at Stony Brook, so give us a little idea, a better idea, of what scientists learn from the improv world. What do they take home? Alan has started us off on that.
Yeah, right. A lot of it, like Alan said, is just about learning how to listen and be available to whatever's right in front of you, so that you may come in with a really strong plan of this is the thing I'm going to say or this is the talk that I'm going to give. And the tool that they learn in improv is that if that's not working, that they need to be aware of the fact that it's not working and able to make an adjustment on their feet, not feel like they've failed, not feel like, okay, well, I'm just going to try to get this over with, but actually do something in the moment and be able to connect with the people that are listening to them. So the games that we play are a lot about just listening, availability, and being able to make spontaneous adjustments and also bring their own passion to the moment so yeah. that they're coming from a place of excitement in their own world.
So they can react on their feet.
Exactly.
And the people they're talking to,
yeah.
or the people they're writing for, who they don't actually see, be able to figure out what they're going through as they communicate with them. So the focus is on the person listening, not on what you have to tell them. Because what you have to tell them really doesn't matter if they don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Our producer, Christopher Intagliata, went out to visit the Improv for Scientists class at Stony Brook a few weeks ago. And one of the things he heard about was the protractor chair.
We're here to tell you about our product. It's the chair protractor. When you're taking a math test, sometimes you're just like, I don't know what that angle is. So if you roll up your chair and put the piece of paper under it, it'll measure the angle for you. But wait, there's more.
It doesn't only help you on your test, but it helps you sit down. So no matter the size of your derriere, you'll be able to take a seat on this protractor chair. But wait, there's more.
I can see all you people with the bad posture, but the protractor chair will fix that for you because you'll be sitting in 90-degree angles. But wait, there's more.
For a second, I thought I was listening to Ron Popeil do a Vegematic. You know, and if you act now, is that the point of
it? It's set up that way, yeah. It's a game called Beaker Bagel, and the idea is that the students will brainstorm about something from their daily work life that they often use, and they'll write down that object, and then something that they touched this morning, an object that they use, and they'll work in teams and choose an object from each pile, and the instruction is that as a team they have 1 minute to think about how they would pitch this if it was one item for a television audience.
So two disparate words are combined on the spot. They don't expect those words to be put together,
right?
And then they have to think of a product that represents those two words.
And the directive is that they have to think about helping us understand what it is, mm-hmm. what it does, and why it's important to our everyday life. And it's what it does is it really brings them out of their shells. Even shy students kind of go to outrageous places in this. But the takeaway is that science is to some degree the same kind of an abstraction, and the listener needs to know what it is, right. what it does, and why we should care about that.
And I'm sure this is something you faced when you were hosting Scientific American Frontiers. And it's something we face here on Science Friday, and that is, how do you get the real human to come out, right?
That's exactly what this does. Excuse me. This gives the person playing the games the opportunity to emerge from the facade that sometimes is required in the professional world. With your actual personal self, when that's freed, you tend to, your own sense of humor comes out, although that's not the primary objective. But most of all, this personal tone, a personal tone of voice, a personal regard, your gaze at the people you're looking at is genuine, direct. You're not looking at them in general. You're reading their entire face. You're looking into their eyes. You're noticing every line. Notice your little half smile now. You know, if I weren't trained in this, I might take it for granted that whatever's happening on your face is not necessarily connected to what's going on in your head.
But that's part of acting is the reacting, right?
That's it.
It's the most important part.
It becomes
probably.
Interactive that
right.
way.
Right. Val, another improv exercise our producer heard was something called a rant. And here's Rachel Sampson, a physics major at Stony Brook.
So one thing that really, really bothers me is my little brother. He's 16 years old, and he is so entitled right now. You know, my mom drives him to school every day, and he'll come down 5 minutes late. My mom has to get to work on time and everything, and he'll come down yelling at her, "Why were you honking at me?" Like, he's just so angry at her, and he'll get in the car, and he'll just yell at her and yell at her, and she's doing him a favor, but he doesn't realize that.
And Val, the rant helps to do what? Free your mind?
Exactly. You've got to get rid of all this stress. The rant is only the first part of the exercise. The second part is when you have to turn the rant around and describe the person in positive terms. And so maybe Rachel's partner would introduce her to the audience in a different way than what they had heard from the rant.
So this is Rachel, and she's really passionate about her little brother. She understands the nuance of how your personality plays a role into who you're going to be in this world and what it takes to succeed. And the fact that you need to be able to motivate yourself and that you need to be able to get up every day and take accountability for your own actions. She really cares about her brother being able to do the things that he needs to do to succeed.
So how could you use this if you're a scientist and you're faced in this? What kind of situation could you use this
in? Well, this is a really important exercise for both scientists and medical professionals, and we teach a lot of medical students as well. There's often a big rant that's coming at the scientist from the public that has to do with misunderstanding or confusion. And one of two things happens to us when we hear a rant. Either we become defensive or we shut down. And neither one of those can really help the conversation go forward. But if you can think deeper and really look underneath the rant, what it is that's positive, that's driving that person, that can really help you unlock some common ground that you may have with the person on the opposite side and help you move the conversation forward.
And I noticed something very interesting when I was listening to the rant just now. Often these exercises do more than one thing. And one of the extra things I think that I heard happening in that rant was an opening up with energy and affect about what she cared about. The rant gave her the permission to be emotional, to be really present with what she had to say. And when that's applied to their science, when they tell you about what at the present moment is probably the most important thing in their life, they can tell you with the same kind of animation that the rant freed them to do.
Well, I have to become animated and emotional because we have to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk lots more about science and improv with Ellen Alda and Valerie Landsgeffro. So stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about teaching improv to scientists and how to ditch the jargon with my guest, Ellen Alda, actor and writer and board member of the World Science Festival. He is also co-founder and visiting professor at the Ellen Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University out there on Long Island. Valerie Landsgeffro is the improvisation program director at the Ellen Alda Center out there at Stony Brook. Val, during the break, you mentioned you had a real-life example about how the rant exercise works.
We do this. We do a lot of workshops around the country, and we did this rant exercise at a workshop that we had at the University of Maine. And after the workshop, a few of the scientists were getting ready to go to a community meeting that was sort of an ongoing monthly meeting that they had with a group of fishermen. And the meeting was often very contentious, with the fishermen feeling like the scientists were against them and the scientists feeling like they can't get anywhere with the fishermen. And so they did this rant exercise, and they thought, why don't we just try this? We have absolutely nothing to lose. Let's try and just see if we can hear beneath the rant. And they came back the following day to the next improv workshop, and they said it was really amazing what happened, because they said they still didn't reach any consensus in the meeting. But what happened for the first time is that they left the meeting talking to each other. And that had never happened before. And it gave them a lot of hope for where the future could go if they had found some common ground and that they had at least realized that they had some respect for each other and actually liked each other. So the long-distance implications of these exercises can be very surprising.
Because, you know, it's true that these days scientists are so involved in their tiny little communities that they never talk to each other.
That's one of the things
that our work is changing. We notice that when we bring people together from different disciplines, they learn about one another's work for the same time. Sometimes people within the same discipline learn about one another's work for the same time and leave the room talking in a kind of collaborative way.
Alan, do you sort of reinvent these exercises with science communication in mind, or are you just taking what you've learned and just giving them?
No, we adapted. We adapted. And I remember when Val and I first began working together, when we did a series of improv sessions with students at Stony Brook University, I took a game that Viola Spolin called Who Am I, where you come in and you don't know, you come into a room and a person's sitting in the chair and the person doesn't know who they are in relation to you. And only by the way you relate to them do they find out who they are. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun to have the scientist come in and explain his or her work in the lab in such a way that the person in the chair finds out that she's his mistress, she's his wayward daughter, she's his doctor, who's performed badly in an operation. You know, some emotionally charged relationship that can come out not by giving hints, not an intellectual puzzle game, but by the way they relate to them, by the tone of voice, by the words they choose to talk about their work. So what happens is you learn, as in many of these games, you are transformed in a number of ways. One way is you realize there are many ways to talk about your work, not just this one official way that you wrote in the research paper. The other thing you learn is you actually can communicate something to someone without words. I can let you know who you are without giving you hints, but just by my behavior, by my body language, my tone of voice. That's one of the most important things you can learn in communication.
Mm-hmm. Do students ever come back and say, hey, you know, I had this situation where this came in so handy, the stuff that we learn here.
Yeah, I actually had a pretty profound moment with a student this past year. He was a medical student. And we do an exercise called the mirror exercise, where one person is leading a physical movement and the other person has to mirror it. And the exercise begins with a lot of self-consciousness. And what happens through the course of the exercise and some side coaching is that they realize that they need to slow down and be more simple and empathetic for what the follower is going through. So this student came back to me to talk to me after a class, and he is now a third-year medical student and going to see patients. And he had an experience, his first experience, of having to break bad news. And it was to a woman whose cancer had metastasized. And the news was that she had about 2 weeks left to live. And he was terrified going into this conversation because it was, you know, daunting and very emotional. And so he went in with the internist, and the internist told her what was going on. And there was no reaction at all. And he said, we were getting ready to leave the room, and I thought, you know, I just don't think she got it. I don't think she knows what's happening. And so he asked permission to stay and sit with her and talk to her a little bit more. And he was given permission. And he said, I sat down with her, and we held hands. And he said, I told her in the simplest possible way what was happening. I didn't use any three-syllable words. I didn't use the word metastasis. I didn't use the word prognosis. I just tried to be simple and slow, because I knew that there was a pacing to the way that you could hear this information. And he said, for the first time, the woman started to cry.
Wow.
And when she cried, it made him cry. And then when he cried, she had a question. And he said it was really the perfect mirror, where he began the leadership in a slow way so she could stay with him. And then she took over the leadership of the mirror by asking questions. And he said, ultimately, what came out of this is that it was the perfect mirror, where both of them were leading and both of them were following. And he said, what I felt happened was that I was able to help her understand how to understand the end of her life. And she was able to help me understand how to be a better doctor.
And it all stemmed out of the training that he may have gotten about listening.
Right. Well, right?
And paying attention to what...
Right, exactly. And specifically this mirror exercise, which has this mysterious effect of getting you to merge with the other person. In many ways, your brains get synced up. An example, we can't do an example of it on the radio, but we do one that's verbal. You want to do it with
me? Sure.
Okay, you be my mirror, and you say everything I'm saying at exactly the same moment I say it. You're not an echo, you're a mirror.
So
here's what I'm going to tell you. You look wonderful today. Now you lead.
That was a very interesting conversation. Thank you for that compliment. Yeah. And we do that, and you do that exercise.
We do that exercise, and then we tell them, both of you are leading. There's no follower. You're leading at the same time. Now, that sounds impossible, but it actually is possible. Wow. Wow. And the thrill when you're both so tuned into each other that if a person came into the room, they wouldn't know who was leading. That's a wonderful feeling.
It's great. We asked a few of the students at Stony Brook for tips for scientists who want to do a better job talking about their work, or even just listeners who want to be better communicators. And this is what they said.
My name's Kareem Ibrahim, and I'm studying biochem. I think definitely when it comes to science, there's because there's the idea of like factual accuracy or inaccuracy, and there's so much more scrutiny placed on you when you're giving a talk about something that's scientific. But I think at the same time, a lot of the actual what makes up the speech isn't so much the content, but the method by which you get the content across in a manner that is understandable to your audience. And so I think that it's pretty universal, the approach towards connecting to the audience. And I think that this class gives us a setting where we can practice those approaches and be able to do so in an effective way.
Yeah, you use real everyday language?
Yeah.
What a concept. What a concept, exactly.
You know, we find that scientists tell us that after that, these are senior scientists very often, after going through this training with us, they get so used to thinking in basic language and facing the concepts without over-intellectualizing them, that they have a greater understanding of their own work. And that's a wonderful thing. They can actually make more progress in their work because they see it in a fresher way. One scientist told me he doesn't face the data in a way where he tells the data something. He lets the data talk to him.
You know, that's what they say. You really don't know if you understand something until you can explain it in plain English.
Yeah, many great scientists have said that. If you can't explain it to a child, you probably don't understand it so well yourself.
Another thing that's surprising is that our medical students have told us that they're actually learning material easier because they're, as it's being given to them, they're starting to distill it in their own minds and think, if I was to say this in plain language, what would it be? And it's helping it to stick with them longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great advantage. Yeah.
We have one more piece of advice from a student, from Kristen Federici.
I'm Kristen, and I'm a bio major. I'd say break it down. Definitely take your work and think about who you're speaking to. It doesn't really matter if you're speaking to other scientists. They won't mind hearing words, everyday words. They don't need to hear the big ticket items, you know. So I'd say definitely break it down into smaller steps and then build it up to the big picture.
And what about the thinking on your feet aspect, which you guys are amazing at, just making up stuff? How does that apply to when you're talking about something real that has to be factual? And
well, I think if you can come up with some sort of analogy for the audience to understand, even if it's one that you don't think people do every single day, it'll definitely lighten the mood a little bit and help people connect with you. And that, I feel like, is definitely helpful with thinking on your feet.
Yeah, because scientists need to think on their feet more than ever now, especially when they go to Congress.
Right.
You know, try to talk science to the Congress people. You touched briefly on how scientists need to be able to speak in plain language, and that's a natural segue to your new Flame Challenge.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your Flame Challenge.
We just began the Flame Challenge for this year, and every year kids, 11-year-old kids, suggest the questions. And this year the question that came to the top was, what is sound?
What is sound?
Yeah. Boy. And scientists all around the world, we're hoping we'll send in their explanations of what is sound. They have until mid-January to do that. And the trick is, the thing that makes it really an interesting challenge, I think, is that they're not going to be tested on what they know. They're going to be tested on how well they can communicate what they know. And a bright scientist is not going to have trouble getting the basics of sound down. But then how do you communicate that to an 11-year-old? In an engaging way, but not in a silly way, but one that captures their attention and actually teaches them something, because that's what the kids want. And the kids are going to be the judges of the contest.
Yeah. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Alan Ault about the new Flame Challenge, which is about sound. Do you think any of the kids in your course could come back now and try to explain things better?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a winning testimonial, wouldn't it? What I understand is that some grad programs are having their kids do this as a project for grad school. So that's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd love to see scientists take on this challenge, because what it does is, I think you realize how hard it is to do this. Yeah. And it's intriguing to see if you can find a way to incorporate your knowledge of sound into this communication process.
And how did sound get chosen as the topic?
A number of kids asked that question, or a question that implied it, and then we sorted through it, and we were looking at the top, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm on this, Val, I think we were looking at the top suggestions for ones that would bring out the most imaginative responses from the scientists, mm-hmm. would you say?
Right, and a broad range of scientists would be able to answer the question.
And you can, going over the ground rules again, you can use any kind of technique?
We have two categories. One is video, a short video, or a written entry. Those two ways of explaining it are what we're asking for. And we get some really wonderful, elaborate, interesting videos, sometimes very simple ones. Two years ago, was just a guy talking to the camera, but he was very engaging and very accurate about what he says. And all of these entries, by the way, are vetted for accuracy by a panel of scientists before they go to the kids for judging.
Yeah, because I've seen a few of those videos, but the ones that are being judged. And sometimes it's amazing how effective just someone in front.
Right.
You know, and this is how kids operate now, right? They're in front. They're doing selfies and all kinds of things. And so they maybe expect to see more of these kinds of video.
Right. Learning on YouTube. I mean, you know, there's a lot of that kind of video work.
One of the things that we didn't expect to happen with this contest is, and this is the fourth year of the contest, is what a wonderful learning experience it's turned out to be for the kids.
Huh.
One class of kids said, I wish we could learn everything this way. Because you know what happens is they have to become sort of expert in the details of the question, mm-hmm. and the best answer to the question is, so they can judge who gave the best entry. So each class will get a packet of five entries, and they discuss them for as long as the teacher wants to make that part of the learning process. So they get to be very good at figuring out what the most correct answer is, and then their discussions together is an added level of education. They learn to work together, they learn to use critical thinking. It's a wonderful learning experience for them, and we didn't expect that.
Yeah, well, we'll see what comes up this year. Thank you. And we have the link up on our website, and go to your website if you want.
You know,
to
the
enter.
Winner of our first contest, which was What is a Flame, only knew about this contest because of Science Friday.
I didn't want to bring that up, but I'm glad you did. Thank you for that. Alan Ault, actor, writer, board member of the World Science Festival, also co-founder and visiting professor at the Alan Ault Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. And Valerie Linz Geffro is the improvisation program director at that Center for Communicating Science out there in Long Island. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to have you coming.
Thanks.
And happy holidays to you.
Same to you.
You too.
Coming up, the creator of the webcomic XKCD explains nuclear reactors, laptops, electromagnetic spectrum using only common English words. Boy, our jargon-free hour continues after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There's a story about a wager between Dr. Seuss, you know, the famous author, and his editor. The editor bet Seuss that he could not write a story, a good one, with just 50 unique words. The editor lost the bet, and the world got a little book called Green Eggs and Ham, proving once again that you don't need a lot of big words to tell a good story. But do you need big words to explain, say, a complicated science concept or advanced technology? Can you talk about the functioning of an animal cell without mitochondria, or about the inside of a nuclear reactor without uranium? Sounds like a question for the Flame Challenge. Well, my next guest answers these questions and a whole lot more in his new book. It's called The Thing Explainer. Thing Explainer, it's just that complicated things like laptops and jet engines and electromagnetic spectrum explained using pictures and just the 1,000 most common English words. Randall Monroe is the creator of the popular webcomic XKCD and the author of The Thing Explainer, Complicated Stuff in Simple Words. He joins me from Boston. Randall, welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here.
Have you heard that story about Dr. Seuss?
You know, I had. I think I heard it years ago and had not thought about it until now. I never made that connection.
Yeah, well, you do amazing things in this book, Thing Explainer. Well, what was the inspiration for it?
You know, it's funny. It goes back to a comic I drew where I tried to explain the Saturn V in just 1,000, the 1,000 most common words. But that actually came from when I was playing a space video game where I had to name spaceships. And I was just trying to give them the dumbest names I possibly could because I got tired of majestic names like Falcon or Apollo or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I started calling them things like Upgoer and Flying Tube. And I felt like Upgoer was about the dumbest name I could think of. And then that got me thinking, could I describe the whole thing that way with just simple, dumb words?
Well, I'm looking at the page, the Saturn V, which you call the U.S. Space Team's Upgoer 5. And I love my most favorite part of this. It's like a blueprint page. And it labels a part that says, the part that flies around the other world and comes back home with the people in it and falls in the water. What made you think that this could all be put together as a book? All these things that you want to explain.
Well, I drew the Saturn V as a comic, and then I was really happy with how that worked out, and I posted it on my website. And then I was thinking, hey, I liked that a lot. I could do another one. You know, maybe I should do a space station or maybe something like a mountain or a tree or whatever. And then the more I thought about it, the more of these ideas I had. And so I just started collecting them. And after I published my first book, I said, hey, books work well for this kind of thing. And the resolution of print is really high, which means I can squeeze in tons and tons of detail, and I always am a sucker for that.
Now, before you were a full-time comic artist, you were a roboticist at NASA, right? So you must have used some jargon. Is that something that you thought about at the time when you were writing all this jargon? You know, this should be easier than this.
Yeah, and I mean, I think just in any kind of academia, there's a lot of And in technical work in general, there's a need for jargon because you sometimes need to be very clear about what things you're talking about. But there's also a lot of pressure to not feel stupid and to not have people think you're stupid. And I think that it would sometimes push me to like use big words when I didn't always need to, or, you know, not call the Earth, you know, a ball or round or whatever, because I was worried that someone would correct me and say it's technically an oblate spheroid.
Yeah.
I think that the more I kind of tried to strip away that insecurity and just worry about, you know, what's the clearest way I could say this, the more I realized that, you know, simple words often do the trick.
So you compiled a list of 1,000 common words that you would stick to in the book?
Yep.
How hard was that to do?
That actually is a lot of work because there are a lot of different ways you can define what the most common words are. You know, if you do things based on, you know, movies or a Project Gutenberg old books collection or a modern book collection or subtitles on TV shows or newspapers, you know, you'll get different lists. So like newspapers will use like words like president or debt or whatever more often, whereas TV shows will have a lot more words like or hello. And so I did a sort of mix of a bunch of different sources to try to come up with a list of words that really fit our general sense of what common is.
And because the word requirements lead to some pretty funny translations. I mentioned a couple of them, but let me go into a few more. A microwave oven is a food heating radio box. What were some of your favorite ones?
My very favorite ones, you know, I liked calling a rover a space car and calling a space station a shared space house, the International Space Station. But I think my very favorite ones were my names for all of the animals in the very last illustration in the book is a tree of life, where I just picked out a bunch of animals and gave them new names. And so bats are skin birds, since I can't say bat. And then I broke there are dinosaurs. And so I had a couple of different branches of dinosaurs. There's the pointy kind, the kind with plates, the long kind, and the bitey kind, and then birds. And I just had a lot of fun trying to come up with a name, because there are a couple of animals whose names were on the list, like cat and dog. And so then I could use those, but then for all the other animals, some of them I would say, like, you know, like ferrets, they're long bitey dogs or smelly dogs, and that, you know, and so I could come up with new names based on the few animal names I could use.
You mentioned that you draw all these blueprints, and you draw them, they get very detailed. Did drawing this book push you as a comic artist?
Yeah, and it's sort of, in a way, it was like stepping back from comics, but a little bit more toward my childhood, because I didn't grow up drawing comics, but I did grow up drawing detailed maps of things and diagrams of inventions I wanted to build. And so with this, I got to go back, and it was a lot more like that kind of drafting I did when I was younger. And it was hard not to get sucked into just adding more and more and more detail.
There must have been other books that you, as a child, right, saw that were something like this, that you said you must have used something for inspiration.
Yeah, well, I grew up devouring books like The Way Things Work by David McCulley.
Great book.
And The Secret House was another one that was a book of just stuff that happens in your house that you can't necessarily see. So they had like microscope views of the things that would be living on your table or wherever.
Right, right.
But one of the surprising ones was I really liked Where's Waldo? And I never really liked Finding Waldo because that was always kind of hard and frustrating. But what I loved was, you know, looking over these murals and looking at all the action. Yeah. And so when I was doing this book, I sort of deliberately made it unorganized so that you could just pick anywhere and start looking and try to see what details you were looking at.
When I was a kid, I had a math book. There was a Golden Book series. The Golden Book of this. Remember those? Golden Book of Mathematics. I remember the first time it explained how the Egyptians had done their math and how you could get pi from dropping toothpicks on the floor. And this book reminds me of that kind of genre, but I never know who these, because I'm a big kid, and I'm a geeky kid. I'm certainly an adult, but I love reading these kinds of books and how they're explained. So I never know who these books are aimed at. Do you have an audience that you aim the books at?
Honestly, I don't. I never really know who the stuff I'm writing at is aimed at either, because when I'm writing it, I'm just thinking about myself before I knew the thing I'm writing about. You know, how would I, I did a bunch of research to find out the answer to some question or find out how, something works. And then I think, okay, if I want to save myself all the time of all that research, if I could send back in time a short summary, what would it be? And so for some of these things, the explanations are, you know, were there things that I learned about when I was a little kid, like bridges, you know, the explanations might be more aimed at kids, but, you know, some of the other things I only learned about, you know, a lot of them while I was researching for this book. And so I sort of aim it at someone who's my age. I hope that it's clear enough and appropriate enough that kids can like it and adults will like it too.
Was there some idea or a concept or device you had to discard? You say, I would like to explain this, but it's just impossible for me. Let's give up on it.
One that I thought about was a piano. And I ended up not including that. And I think partly because with some of these mechanisms, and another one would be a mechanical pocket watch, which you don't see too many of anymore, but, you know, they're full of all these gears. There might be long words in watchmaking, you know, for each of those parts. But in a sense, it's just not something that's easy to attach words to. It's just this is a gear, and it's shaped like this, and it fits into an arm that's shaped like this. But there's almost nothing words can add to it. And so I think there were a few of those things where I said, you know, I don't know how to describe those in any words, let alone small ones.
I was also impressed that you explained the periodic table, which is basically just a diagram filled with big, very specialized words. How did you tackle that?
The periodic table was really one of the very few places in the book where I tried to, for the rest of the book, I tried to describe what everything did. You know, I would find something about it and explain how it worked. But for the periodic table, for some of the elements, especially in the very bottom rows, there just isn't a lot to say about them. And so I had to make it sort of a Jeopardy puzzle. I just described what they were named after. So I said, you know, like this one is named after this guy. And I had a little, you know, cartoon of Albert Einstein. Or, you know, this one is named after this place. And there's a silhouette of California for like Californium or Einsteinium. Because there really isn't anything all that interesting about those metals. But for the upper parts of the chart, I got to make a lot more connections, you know, and describe, like, this rock is really well known for killing you if you eat it, for arsenic.
Yeah, the rock that makes up beaches, glass, and computer brains.
Yeah,
is another rock.
Yes, silicon.
I didn't know this, but there are four elements named after the same tiny Scandinavian town? What's going on there?
That's the town of Yitterby, I think. I've never heard it pronounced. But it was a town where there was a mine near the town where they extracted a lot of rare earth metals. And because of that, a bunch of element discovery happened around there. And so there are four separate elements that are named after this town. There's, you know, elements like ytterbium and terbium and yttrium and I think erbium. And I'm sure it's a really nice town, and you know, it I've seen some pictures. It looks like a great place, but it's very small, and it seems sort of odd to me that like 2-3% of all substances in the universe are named after this town.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You explain things like the Curiosity rover, the Large Hadron Collider, but you also explain how a data center works. How did you hit on that as a thing that needed explaining?
Yeah, it's funny. We talk about and we think about all this data. I actually did a survey a while back where I asked people, like, when you are looking at the internet, is there somewhere where you sort of unconsciously picture all of this stuff being before it's on your screen? You know, where do you think of this being stored? And most people just said, somewhere underground or in a satellite, or a lot of them said a building out in Montana or one of the western states. But so I thought it was good to sort of make it concrete. You know, there's a little comic going around recently about, by I think Rich Stevens, about that just said the cloud is someone else's computer. And I like that. So I wanted to show people, you know, all that stuff on Facebook, it's in these buildings, and here's what they're like inside, and here's why they're like that.
You know, I was speaking with Alan Alda earlier in the hour about how scientists can be better communicators. Having written books in very simple language, do you have any advice for scientists?
I mean, I think it would be good if scientists can be better communicators, and I think But I also think it might be a little unrealistic to expect them all to be. I mean, it would be great if everyone was good at everything. But I think, you know, not all scientists can be Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, they're a lot of them are too busy being scientists. But I think, you know, if you're trying to write and communicate with the public, I think just keeping in mind that the words that you think of as really clear and easy to understand might not be, and it's really hard to get over that. Mm-hmm. And there was a story recently about how when they interviewed people about antibiotic resistance, people across the board at every education level didn't get what was meant by the phrase antibiotic resistance. And for people in the medical community, everyone was so used to it that was kind of a big surprise. But they found that people were assuming that the phrase meant their bodies became resistant to the antibiotics, not the germs. And that's a really important difference. And so they said, you know, we should instead say the bacteria are getting stronger. You know, the germs are getting stronger. Mm-hmm. But I think it's hard to remember that different people from, you know, different areas use different sets of words.
Now, I know that people reading this book, and I'm surely hoping there's a follow-up that you're working on. I know that they want to try writing their own explanations in simple language. You have a tool for them.
Yeah, when I was writing this book, because no one, you know, I couldn't just keep looking up on a list every time I use a word, I wrote a tool that would check my text as I'm typing it. And with some help, I put together a version of that tool on my website, which you can get to at xkcd.com/simplewriter.
Wow. Is there a follow-up coming up at all?
Not just yet. I think I'm resting my hand after all those illustrations.
But you know, you know what's going to happen. People are going to want you to write another book with all the things that were left out of this book, right?
Well, how about I could always do another book that's where I can't use any of the simple words. I have to use the other 29,000 English words that people know, but I can't use the or and.
Wow.
I think that might be impossible.
Call that the encyclopedia. we've run out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, and I'll take his cue to use the simplest words that I can. Randall Monroe draws pictures and writes words that make you think and laugh. You can see them on your computer at xkcd.com. His new book is called Thing Explainer. Randall, thanks for joining us today, and have a happy holiday.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ira.
You can see some pictures and words from Thing Explainer at sciencefriday.com. Learn all about the U.S. space team's car for the red world. That's NASA's Curiosity rover, of course, at sciencefriday.com/thingexplainer. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Graskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. And Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Hope everybody had a happy Thanksgiving holiday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.